Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, if you've been listening to American Variety over the last several years, you recognize that we have a fairly frequent theme called Old Florida Days, which delves into different aspects of the old history of Florida, you know, ranging from sort of prehistoric to pre-white man to, old ranchers and people who lived here in the waning frontier days and that kind of thing. And we've also had on lots of authors and a number of crime novelists over the years. My guest today, actually, and the subject of today's show really combines both those things. His name is Jonathan King. He's a former journalist who lives in Boca Raton, but was for, I guess, about 24 years, a police and court reporter with the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale and also with the Philadelphia Daily News. Welcome, Jonathan.
Court, good to be here.
Thanks for being on with us. Jonathan's calling in from South Florida, where his novels are set. Mostly he is the author of a crime series called the Max Freeman series, which is, I gather, I haven't read those, but set in the Everglades and on the gritty streets of urban South Florida, so kind of a Miami Vice-like setting. His first novel in 2002 won the Edgar Allan Poe Award, which is the top award in crime mystery fiction. So I gather that the series is kind of in the general genre of Carl Hiaasen and Tim Dorsey's work, although maybe not without the crazy zany characters. Would that be right? Are they more serious?
Both of those guys are extremely funny.
Oh, okay. All right.
And we usually make fun of the fact that I'm the non-funny Florida writer. So, no, I don't do the zaniness at all, mostly because I'm simply taking stuff out of my head that I reported and saw and did as a crime reporter for many years. So I tend to stick towards the believable stuff that really happened, change the names to protect the innocent.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was surmising, really, although I read somebody described you as being like Carl Hiaasen and so on. That person obviously has also not read your series, but anyway, so those are more like straight crime mystery. But we've got Jonathan King on today to talk about his latest novel, which is not in that series. It's an historical fiction novel set around the turn of the last century, published in 2009, and called The Styx. So that's STYX, like the river in Greek mythology. And it, again, is not that Miami Vice-like setting at all. It's based on real history and a real event, or at least the legend of a real event. So with that lead-in, Jonathan, I'm going to ask you to just describe, you know, fairly briefly, the basic storyline of the book, The Styx.
It very much is a hybrid of my two great loves, which is mystery and history. So I blended the two. The incident itself, as you said, it is a myth, so to speak, but it has endured over 100 years. And the myth was that when Henry Flagler had built the Royal Poinciana Hotel on the island of Palm Beach and turned it into really a wonderful Eden for his rather wealthy New York friends to come down. At that time, it was the largest tourist hotel in the world. Mm. And there is an enduring myth that as the land values on the island began to raise, Henry's his workers for that hotel, mostly black southern workers who did the cooking and the cleaning and the laundry and so on, they had built themselves a little village on the island. They named it the Styx, STYX. And the myth is that as all things in Florida, as the land started to rise in value, someone had their eye on that beautiful piece of property on the island of Palm Beach. And the myth is that one night all of the workers that lived in the Styx were asked to come across Lake Worth to the fledgling town of West Palm Beach at the time for a free night of entertainment and food and music and dance. And while they were there, the Styx burned to the ground. And then without their village to go back to, Mr. Flagler magnanimously said, "I will build you all new housing, not to worry, but the new housing will be in West Palm Beach on the other side of the lake." So that is the myth, and certainly I turned the myth a little bit on its head. I'd heard the story many, many times, but in a good mystery, even in the myth, no one died, no one perished in the fire. And certainly in my book, The Styx, you have to have a body if you write a good mystery. So
yeah.
The body shows up in The Styx, but it is the body of a very well-dressed white man.
Mm.
And the idea that somebody dressed like that and the fact that a white person would even be in The Styx a fantastic discovery, and because of the bad press, they quickly covered it up. So in the mystery vein, you need to find out who the body was and who the killer was, and that follows form, as all good mysteries do. The beautiful part of this one is the fact that it's not like any book you've read before, because it is set in the late 1890s of Florida. So you get a chance to see that old history sort of come alive on the page. And it was great fun to write.
You know, so it's a novel, and there's a romantic interest in there. You know, there's a young woman who really is the heroine in a way throughout the book, until at the end there's a twist where she turns out not to be the brave, egalitarian young woman.
She is not quite what you were led to believe all along, and that's certainly another part of our trade as mystery writers, to sort of keep the reader on the edge of their seat a little bit, trying to figure out who done it. And although most of my books reveal early on who done it, in this one I wasn't even sure. As I wrote the book, the characters started to do things on their own, and the love interest was not supposed to be anything more than just a love interest, and then she ended up to being a very complicated character in her own right.
But she's the daughter of one of Flagler's employees, I guess one of the managers and or developers of that property. And really, you know, the whole story is set in this time of tremendous greed and duplicity that accompanied the enormous land boom in South Florida. And really, it was the early days of that land boom. I mean, you're talking here about the late 1890s, really mid to late 1890s. And the super land boom really exploded probably from, I don't know, 1919 to 26 or 7 or so, but it was really starting to build then, and there was a wild scramble for land, and after it became obvious that this scrub-laden and sandspur-filled island over across from Lake Worth was going to be very valuable property, there was a lot of duplicity going on, and so the story involves the different levels of people who were lying and cheating each other. The guy you described as being found dead in the sticks, which is an odd name in a way. Offhand, you'd think that a shanty town named the Sticks would be spelled STICKS, but apparently,
exactly, yeah.
You know, like the Boondocks, but apparently the people who lived there, you know, these poor black workers, as you described, actually did name it the Sticks, which, of course, is in Greek mythology, is the river that divides heaven from hell. So that was pretty evocative of them to name the place that way. But this guy who's found dead there is a very aggressive, what was called a binder boy, right, who had come down from New York. And a lot of these young guys came down to make their fortune. Why don't you describe a little bit, Jonathan, about how that whole racket worked?
Yeah, the binder boys, I guess they became much more prevalent in that area that you were talking, the 1910s and the 1920s. Before the big bust, and the binder boys, their mode of operation was to come to Florida with a bit of a stake from relatives or friends or someone that simply wanted them to go down and make some profit with that money. They would take out a binder on a piece of property, however big it be in Florida, and in that binder they didn't have to make that first payment, that first mortgage payment on the land until, say, the 30th of next month. And so their strategy was to get the binder and then watch it increase in value over the days and try to sell it for a profit before they had to make the first payment.
So they were the first flippers, really. And
they were house flipping. Yes.
Yeah.
they were house flipping at the time.
Right.
And they carried everything around in their binders. They're pretty well documented, especially in the Miami area,
mm-hmm.
after the turn of the century in the 1910s and 1920s. And whoever unfortunately got caught with the binder at the end, you know, it's like a ring around the rosy. If you still have the binder in your hands when the amount of money comes due and you can't get rid of it, then you've got it. Now, in some cases, that worked out wonderfully as the land became more and more and more valuable. But in the time of, you're talking the 1920s, when the great land bust of Florida occurred, I suppose there were a few losers involved in that.
Oh, I'm sure there were, and as there were recently. But so it was, you know, it was a Ponzi scheme, basically a giant game of musical chairs, as you describe it. And the last guy standing when the music ends is holding the bag and loses what he's got in it, and the price has gone up and up. And so people are flipping it, and and hoping to flip it before the Piper came due. But so this guy was really very enterprising and was in on the very early ground floor of that kind of thing. And so there were poor boys like him who came from rough areas of New York or wherever it might be, came down to try to make their fortune. And then there were the magnates, the tycoons like Henry Flagler and Plant on the West Coast, whose henchmen were dealing in large tracts of land. And so the two of them would be playing each other. those two sets of con men would be playing each other, in effect. And sometimes people would lose big time like this guy did. But so yeah, a lot of the book...
And landowners who were already landowners, and certainly those a little bit behind them, they tried very hard to follow Flagler. Flagler kept the route of his railroad as he was building it from Jacksonville down, eventually to Key West. The land speculators knew that he was up to something, and they tried to follow his route ahead of him so that they could raise the land prices, knowing that he was coming. So he tried to keep his routes very, very secretive when he was building the railroad down. And if some group of landowners really tried to stick it to him, he would simply change the route of the railroad and say, no, I don't need your land. I'll find another way. So, a lot of that big business was going on all over. But Flagler was a partner with John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. Those guys already knew how to do business.
You're listening to American Variety. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Jonathan King about his recent book, The Styx, STYX, which is about a turn of the century, the turn of the last century, land speculation and a murder mystery that goes on in this fiction book, based on real events, though, in and around Palm Beach, in West Palm Beach. And so there is that underlying story of the greed and so on going on with the land speculation and everything that went on with it. And as you say, the legend is that Flagler had this shanty town that was built by black workers near the site of his grand hotel, the Royal Poinciana Hotel. He had that burned down when they were lured across the across Lake Worth to a fair one night. But we'll talk about that later, because there are different theories and different myths about what went on there, and it's kind of always been a long-running mystery in Palm Beach County. But another underlying theme of the book is the huge gulf between blacks and whites, in other words, the race relations in the Jim Crow era. And that's part and parcel of this whole thing with the ability to get away with, you know, burning down a town, a village, you know, that's wasn't owned by those people. They were just renters there. But but so part of this whole thing is, you know, the kind of the friendships and the alliances between some of the, you know, the very strong black people there who, you know, worked hard and had great character with some of the white people. And then on the other hand, you have basically lynchings, which were, you know, legal murders that were carried out. And so some of these things were going on in the background of this story, too. So it really is pretty realistic about the gritty reality of race relations back at that time, which ranged from absolute callous murders to, you know, friendships and cooperation. So tell us a little bit about some of the storyline there, maybe.
Yeah, this was the 1890s, so you're only 40 years out after the Civil War, so things and Florida certainly at that time being considered very much of a deep Southern state. The idea that that we have our concept today is that it's a very modern state, but back then it was just a deep Southern state with that kind of mentality that folks had grown up with for generations and generations. So the idea that you would start to bring perhaps more enlightened New Yorkers, where they were used to a different sort of race relations, building them down into the deep South, it did cause tension, and it did cause certainly some problems. One of the little vignettes that I found doing the research with Flagler was since Flagler did not want any motor cars or anything on the island, that kept up for many, many years, but the way to get around on his very opulent grounds, he used a little carriage system. It was a marriage between a wicker carriage and a bicycle. Now you see those even today in some urban areas where taxi drivers have taken on this quaint little idea. But at the time, they were not only were they available to the tourists to take tours around Flagler's Place, but they were called, in advertising, Afromobiles.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, the advertisements, I have several of them that I've taken pictures of and looked at, because the bicyclists themselves were blacks. They were African Americans at the time, and they exclusively had those jobs. But there was not even a blink of the eye to be called Afromobiles, and so that's how the genteel got around on Flagler's Island at the time.
So kind of a
Very interesting, kind of
a rickshaw.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. And like I said, at the time it was not even blinked at the idea that this was. And of course, I also had to include in the book the fascinating fact that they had baseball teams, black baseball teams that were on the hotel circuit, and they were employed by the hotels as waiters and so on. But during certain parts of the day, they played baseball for the entertainment of the guests.
I see.
Certainly, it was winter time, so you couldn't enjoy a game up in New York City. But when you came to stay at the Royal Poinciana Hotel, you got to see baseball games out in the back, where Flagler had a beautiful baseball diamond built. And so I included that, and it did include some rather some names. Satchel Paige originally pitched on one of the hotel league teams. So I included that in the book. I created a fictional character who plays on the baseball team.
I'm sure teams like that ended up producing the players in the Negro League, which was very very successful baseball league.
Yeah,
but again, a separate but equal baseball league. And I imagine
the interesting part of that was that the most successful team was out of New York. And because if they did the Southern Circuit, they weren't allowed as blacks or as African Americans or as Negroes to be on the hotel grounds. So they created a team in New York, and they called themselves the Cuban Yankees. And they all adopted Hispanic names.
Is that right?
So that when you saw the list of the players on the Cuban Yankees, they were all Ruiz, and because they changed their names so that they would be considered Cuban and not Negro, and then they could get into the hotel to play the other teams.
And so I guess that subterfuge succeeded, although everybody must have seen through it based on the lack
I'm sure they did, but they didn't care.
Yeah, that's right.
They wanted to see good basketball, and they did get entertained by some really wonderful players.
So. Yeah, whatever it took. But, you know, so I'm old enough to remember the very end of the Jim Crow era in the early to mid-60s in the South, and it was basically, you know, a totally separate worlds that kind of intermeshed but didn't really touch, you know, as our older readers, I mean, listeners may remember that, but the black society was its own complex social organization, and really in many ways was a very cohesive society, but it was separate and in a way invisible to white society, you know. So that's how there was a village called the Styx just a few hundred yards from this grand hotel. And I guess that leads us to talking about some of the controversies that exist about how the kind of the shantytown for the Afro-American help called the Styx was destroyed. And so in your book, it was as you describe, which is that Flagler and his men put on a show, a fair or a carnival across Lake Worth, and invited, gave free tickets to and transportation to all of the inhabitants of the Styx, and then burned the place to the ground while they were gone that night. That's one version of it, but other versions exist, including things that I've read online that were interviews even into the 90s of people who were children at the time who lived in the Styx at the time and said, no, it really was they were given notice and were told to just take their belongings and move, you know, go across the bridge to this other place that was being built up for them. And after they'd left, the place was knocked down, whether by bulldozers or people or whatever, and then the piles of debris were burned. And other versions exist in which really Flagler didn't own this land, but other landowners around Palm Beach County owned bits and pieces of the land that the Styx was on, and different ones of them pushed the renters out and, you know, sold that land in bits and pieces, and that kind of the destruction of it took place really in a span between 1904 and even 1912, and that there was plenty of notice given and that kind of thing. So there are different stories about how harsh it was, but in the end, the people living there were paying a few dollars a month for rent and had no choice. They had to leave. But it kind of does make sense on a common sense basis to me that if you're going to build another place for them, that you would have already built that and moved them to it before you knocked the first residence down, rather than have them go across the bridge and stand around for 6 months while they built an alternate quarters for them. So I'm not having been there, I'm not really sure what happened, and I guess the myth will endure beyond this show, right? But
I believe that all in any of those descriptions could be true. There were not real good, clear, that I was able to find, good, clear descriptions of the time when it actually occurred. There are photographs of the sticks, so it absolutely did exist. The photographs showed some very extensive buildings. These weren't just simply little squatters' cabins. They were extensive. So it was a fairly large community. Flagler employed about 2,000 people that worked at the Poinciana. So it was a fairly large community. So I think you might be correct in that Flagler didn't absolutely own the property. It was owned by somebody else, and in the late 1800s, it was probably worthless scrubland, worthless island scrubland at the time. But then, under the influence of Flagler and all his money, New York friends who were coming down and saw what a beautiful place this was and what a great place to spend the winter, they started snatching this property up, and that drove the land boom. And you could see if you've got a bunch of squatters sitting on land that is becoming more and more valuable any minute, I could see all kinds of human endeavor going on there. So, yeah, history has a way of fluxing and changing as the years go by. So it's interesting in that I do, through fiction, sort of pin the whole thing on a freelance land speculator. So the idea that Flagler even had anything to do with it at all is something that's not specific in this book. The book really kind of puts things on the backs of human nature, what people do to one another, and when people get pushed into corners, how they react. And sort of the human existence, as we all know today, has existed for a very, very, very long time, and people don't change. The things around us all change, but there are basics about human beings that will not.
Yep, the surfaces change, the styles change, the cosmetics change, but the core remains the same. And I guess one part of that is that no matter who owned that land, whatever Flagler wanted, in the end, Flagler got, right? But
Flagler was there. Certainly, no one would argue the fact that he was the CEO and the general of the army. I'm not sure that anything happened on Palm Beach Island that he didn't have some sort of approval. I mean, he was the king. So, and everybody recognized that, and he did very marvelously philanthropic things, just as you could say about those great Gilded Age barons, Vanderbilt and Carnegie Mellon and
Rockefeller,
J.P. Morgan. Those men all did wonderful philanthropic things. But then on the other, on the darker side, Flagler also employed prison inmates to build the rail line. Rented them from the state of Florida for pennies a day to put the ties down to build his railroad. So was he a wonderful man for doing some things and a little bit heinous for others? Absolutely, but he's human just like the rest of us. So.
Well, in those days, I guess the tycoons got rich by being meaner and tougher and sometimes luckier than everybody else, but later on, as they got extremely rich, they probably turned to trying to buy their way into heaven or whatever it would take. But anyway, you're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're here almost in heaven talking with Jonathan King, who's the author of a novel called The Sticks, STYX, about a series of events set in Palm Beach County back around the turn of the 1900s and late 1890s and into the first decade of the 1900s, which was really the beginning of the time when Palm Beach began to flower as a mecca for the rich and famous. But south of there, it was still a frontier jungle, basically, because the rail line stopped at that point in Palm Beach. Wherever Flagler took his railhead to, a big resort hotel would spring up, and the place would instantly become civilized with golf courses and polo and people wearing suits to breakfast and that sort of thing. But in Miami, even at that time, things were extremely primitive still. Why don't you give us a couple of just anecdotes about Miami around the same time that your book is set in?
Oh, yeah. That was when Julia Tuttle lived there, and she was trying to convince Flagler to bring the railroad down. Yeah, Miami being a very small fishing village at the time, and was doing a history several years ago for the newspaper. I was doing a 100-year history of South Florida, and I did a sort of a retrospective on medical treatment in Miami during that day, and ran across the diary of a physician who was working in Miami in the 1890s and was called from his offices to attend to a man who he quickly diagnosed as having appendicitis, and he needed to do emergency surgery. The man was found in the stable, of course, horse stables, and since the lighting was so poor, he couldn't perform the appendectomy inside, so they simply moved the man out into the street, and he performed the surgery on the street, and even paid a young boy a couple of coins to, as he wrote in the diary, to wave the flies away while I was busy at my work. So the idea that this was, yeah, certainly a time when Miami was just a very small village of fishermen, and sometimes the sailboats, of course, would stop on their way around the tip of Florida and on their way back up Fort Miami. At one time, there was a fort that was built on the shore on Biscayne Bay. About the same era when there were ships that bringing various goods from New Orleans around the tip of Florida to get into the Gulf Stream, which was a nice 3-mile-an-hour river that ran all the way to New York. So it was a wonderful way for them to make time and use that Gulf Stream. And it comes in, obviously, close to Florida here at the southern tip. And there was a wonderful description of a shipwreck that was laden with barrels of claret wine. The wine kegs, of course, floated to the beach. And one man described how he could go nearly a mile to the Hillsborough Lighthouse just jumping from keg to keg to keg, and his feet never touched the sand.
Well, kind of like bales of marijuana in the 80s, right? But
exactly. It was not our square grouper that we're used to in the 80s, but it was barrels of claret, and the lighthouse keeper bragged about how he had taken a bath in claret wine because he rolled up a few of the barrels and filled his bathtub and actually took a bath in claret.
Unreal. My grandmother moved to Miami in 1906 when she was a 4-year-old girl and with her family. And at that time, the streets were dirt and mud streets in the summer. And the sidewalks, to the extent they existed, were board sidewalks. And the buildings were made of wood. And it was a frontier town back then. But so to get from West Palm or Palm Beach down to Miami, you had to sail or you had to go by steamship by way of Havana. I mean, it was a number of years more before there was a road put down to Miami. Well, Jonathan, we sure appreciate you being on with us on American Variety and talking about your book, The Sticks. People can go to Jonathan's website, which is http://Jonathan, and that's with an O, Jonathan, O-N, King, so jonathanking.com. And it's published by Middle River Press, which has a website, middleriverpress.com, and other Florida-related books are available there. So, Jonathan, thanks again for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you very much, Court. It was fun.
It was our pleasure. Thanks again to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.